From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rami Khoury, internationally syndicated columnist and former editor of the Jordan Times. Khoury is Palestinian-Jordanian. We'll discuss the peace agreement between Israel and the PLO and the impact it will have on the Middle East and on his own life. Also today, writer Frank Conroy. Ever since he wrote his acclaimed memoir, Stop Time, people were expecting him to write a novel. Now, 26 years later, he's written one. Conroy has also headed the NEA Literature Program and now heads the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And Gail Pemberton reflects on the importance of African-American magazines. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to top UN officials, Libya has told UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali it is now willing to give up for trial in Scotland two suspects in the bombing of a Pan Am flight over Scotland 5 years ago. But U.S. officials are reacting with some skepticism to Libya's latest offer to allow the two men to stand trial. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
According to reports by the Libyan news agency JANA, Tripoli has lifted its objections to having the two suspects in the Lockerbie bombing stand trial in Scotland. The suspects are believed to be Libyan intelligence agents, and the government has until now refused to allow their departure. However, even though the government no longer objects to the two men standing trial, it's far from clear they will voluntarily turn themselves over to Scottish authorities. A U.S. official played down today's announcement from Tripoli, adding that the issue is not what Libya says it will do, but whether the two agents will actually be handed over. The Libyan move comes as the U.S., Britain, and France prepare to push for the imposition of additional economic sanctions on Tripoli for its failure to hand over the two suspects. There is mounting speculation that today's announcement is aimed at delaying the new sanctions. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Washington, President Clinton has come to the defense of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, who has been accused of accepting money from a Vietnamese businessman in exchange for helping to improve U.S. relations with Hanoi. Mr. Clinton said that Brown has told him that he has done nothing wrong, and the president said that he has no reason not to believe him. Meanwhile, two Republican congressmen have called for an independent prosecutor in the matter. NPR's Brian Naylor has more on the story.
The GOP congressman, Dana Rohrabacher of California, and Dan Burton of Indiana questioned Brown this afternoon during a hearing on trade. Brown said the accusation that he accepted $700,000 from a Vietnamese businessman was preposterous and ridiculous.
I might also point out that the individual, an individual, made an allegation, is an individual who has never met me, never seen me, never talked to me, never had any contact with me, by his own admission. And it seems to me you should be just as concerned about that kind of allegation being made and what could be the motivation for it as you would have in trying to raise issues that are not before this committee today. I don't have anything more to say on that matter.
The FBI and a federal grand jury in Miami are investigating the charges against Brown, who said he is confident he will be totally exonerated. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The government says that falling oil prices helped push import prices down in August after drops in both June and July. The Labor Department says prices paid for foreign-made goods slid 0.1%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Moscow, government officials have extended a deadline for hardliners to leave parliament, saying they now must be out by Monday. Yesterday, police said that lawmakers camped inside the building for more than a week had to be out by this morning, but then said that failure to end the standoff by Monday might lead to serious consequences. The government said all those who leave peacefully before the deadline will not be prosecuted. In Washington, the Library of Congress has announced an agreement under which reluctant publishers will deposit so-called electronic books in the library for the first time. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Under federal law, any book copyrighted in the U.S. must be deposited in the Library of Congress. But new books and databases published on computer compact discs, or CD-ROMs, have posed a problem for their makers. Unlike a conventional paper library book, which is difficult and expensive to copy in great numbers, electronic books can be easily copied at the push of a computer button or sent around the world via computer networks. So in order to protect their copyrights, three publishers of CD-ROM books negotiated with the Library of Congress for a year and a half and have announced their solution to the problem. Patrons and researchers will have access to the CDs, but only on computers in the library's Washington headquarters, and only if they agree not to reproduce the digital books. The library hopes their announcement will encourage other publishers to start depositing their compact discs as well. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen says the country is on the brink of a strong upswing in the U.S. economy. Bentsen says that low interest rates and low inflation will help lay a foundation for faster growth. Speaking today before the annual meeting of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, Bentsen called on U.S. allies to do their part in helping set the pace for faster economic growth around the world. I'm Ann Taylor, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rami Khoury, is the former editor of the English-language newspaper The Jordan Times. Khoury is a Palestinian-Jordanian living in Amman. He writes an internationally syndicated column, is a publisher, and the author of several books on the Middle East. We called him in Amman earlier today to discuss the peace agreement between the PLO and Israel, how he thinks it will affect his life, and how he thinks it will change the Middle East. Jordan has the largest population of Palestinians in the diaspora. Khoury says that although many Palestinians in Jordan hope to someday live in a Palestinian state, many, like himself, would prefer at this point to remain in Jordan.
I have a business. I have lots of friends. I'm well established. I wouldn't suddenly give up everything I have in Jordan and my commitment to Jordan and to my friends and my colleagues here and suddenly go back because of an emotional commitment to Palestine. I love Palestine and I want to manifest my Palestinian identity, but I'm a human being with links now in Jordan and people like me all over the Middle East as Palestinians who have put down roots.
What does the agreement mean to you personally?
It means several things. The most important thing, I think, is the recognition of the PLO. And the recognition of the PLO by Israel and by the United States is really a symbolic act, but it is a very important symbolic act for me as an individual, because the PLO, despite all of the propaganda and the stereotyping and the even sort of quasi-racist attitudes that have been taken to the PLO in the United States by people who are against it, the PLO is a symbol of our being as Palestinians. It is a symbol. It is a symbol of my existence. It is not a powerful military machine. It is not a sophisticated political machine. It is not an economic or an ideological or any kind of force that will be able to beat the Israelis over the head. It is the dramatic and the very moving assertion of my identity as a Palestinian. It is my cry that I exist, that I will not be beaten, that I will not disappear, that, you know, that the Israelis or the Americans or anybody else may kill us, they may try to ignore us, they may try to buy us out, they may try to imprison us, break our bones, they will try all the things that they have tried over the last 50 years, but they will not defeat us. And the fact that the PLO has been recognized is a very powerful symbol. The second thing that the agreement means is that it is going to start a process that will gradually give us the rights that we are entitled to as Palestinians and as human beings, that we are committed to a gradual phased process of achieving these rights, and that most importantly, it will end the almost 100 years of warfare and bloodshed between us and the Israelis. And, you know, the Israelis are, and the Jews are people who are deeply connected to the Middle East and to my country of Palestine. I mean, the Jewish legacy is a very important element of my culture as a Palestinian Arab. I happen to be Christian myself, so I am a minority in religious terms in the Middle East. The Jews are a minority. But we have always formed component elements of a broader Semitic culture in this region, the Semites being all the children of Abraham, and that we are people who are deeply related to one another and who have to work together closely, as we always have, usually have done throughout history. And I think that's what this agreement means to me, is that it will usher in the beginning of a process of, first of all, psychological détente, and then political reconciliation, and then natural cohesion that will once again see the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews of Palestine working closely together as members of a single community that has existed historically in the land of Palestine for many, many centuries.
I know that you hope that the peace accord between the PLO and Israel will lead to further democratization in the Arab world. What would you like to see happen? I mean, what impact do you think that this agreement could have toward further democratization?
If the Arab-Israeli conflict can be resolved peacefully, hopefully what would happen is that there would be less need for excessive spending on militarization, which would allow Israel and the Arab countries around it to devote more of their budgets to development of economic and human and social development, which would take away from a lot of the autocratic governments in this region the excuse of Israel's occupation and Israel's military threat. And if that excuse is taken away, then the people of these Arab countries would demand more democratic reforms, similar to what has been happening in Eastern Europe in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think this is a process that has already started in many Arab countries. We see it in Jordan, we see it in Yemen, we've seen it in other countries where people have demanded and have been granted elections and more democratic structures. The important thing is to watch this region as it tries to develop a new synthesis between Western or international principles of democratic, sort of Jeffersonian democracy, of voting, of a parliament that has checks and balances with the executive and the judiciary, the democracy that you're used to in North America and the United States, to develop a balance between that and between our own Arab, Islamic, Semitic traditions, which are socially very, very different than the West. I mean, it is unrealistic to expect us to end up looking like Kansas or Rhode Island. It's not going to be like that, because our whole philosophy of life, our social structures, our legal systems, everything here is based on a different precept than yours in the West. You're based on individual rights, and we here are based on sort of communal identity and people working for the same goals as you're working for, but we don't achieve our goals through a focus on individual rights and individual liberties. We achieve our goals by working through communal structures, the family, the extended family, the tribe, the clan, and these are the structures that have given this region a certain continuity and stability for the last 5,000 years.
How do you think the agreement between the PLO and Israel will affect Jordan's political future? The PLO and King Hussein had been at odds with each other. The PLO was thrown out of Jordan in 1970. There's a very large Palestinian population in Jordan now. King Hussein has been sick. He's had cancer. He's getting older. So, I mean, the power dynamics in Jordan are shifting. So what impact do you think this agreement might have on the future of Jordan?
I think it would have a lot of impact down the road. I think it will gradually change the political role of Jordan in the region, and it will diminish it a little bit, in the sense that when you have a peaceful Middle East, when the Arab-Israeli conflict is history, Jordan will not be perceived by Western countries and other Arab countries in the same way that it has been in the last 40 or 50 years, as a sort of a moderate force, a force for stability, a place where Palestinians can live and work and you know, not get into political agitation and military violence, etc., etc. The Jordan has been seen as a kind of essential moderating shock absorber for the Palestine problem, and that has been a lot of the reason why Jordan has been receiving political support and financial aid and diplomatic attention. I think a lot of that will diminish. What will happen, though, is that Jordan's role as a kind of a pioneer of democratization in the region will increase and become more important, and people will look to Jordan as a model of peaceful political evolution. I mean, the Muslim Brothers, for instance, here have been integrated into the system. They've been in parliament, they've been in the cabinet, in the government. They are playing the game by the rules, and it's no big deal, you know. people get up and criticize them, people get up and praise them, and they're not perceived to be this big boogeyman that they are in places like Egypt or Algeria. So that aspect of Jordan will become more important, and I think it will economically thrive in the region. If the region is peaceful, Jordan has a lot of assets that will really see it flourish. It has a highly educated population. I mean, our literacy rate in Jordan is 82%, and this is probably higher than the literacy rate in almost all of the big cities in the United States. We have a highly educated population, a strategic location, a lot of assets in terms of communication routes, transit routes, tourism potential, agriculture. So all of these will really come into play, and I think the economic future of Jordan is going to be very good.
My guest is Rami Khoury, a Palestinian-Jordanian journalist. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Rami Khoury. He's speaking to us from Amman. So how much conflict would you say now there is in Jordan between Palestinians who support the agreement and those who oppose it?
There isn't a lot of conflict. There is a certain political dialogue and a discussion and a debate going on. The majority seem to support it, and there's a minority that opposes it. The minority is expressing its views, and there is an agreement that we deal with this issue within a rational dialogue and an open democratic system. And given those ground rules, the majority is for it, and the agreement will be implemented. There's no doubt.
Who are the people who feel most that the agreement has betrayed them, and what are their reasons?
Well, the Islamists don't like it. The leftists, secular opposition don't like it. The 48 refugees are saying this is not dealing with our status and things of that nature. But all of the people who oppose it do not have a lot of political power, and in many cases do not have a lot of credibility, because their opposition is based on slogans that are a little bit worn out and that don't carry a lot of weight anymore. And therefore, the opposition, I think, has not been able to have much of an impact on this process.
But why do the Islamists oppose the agreement?
They oppose it because they don't think that the PLO, negotiating from a position of weakness, can really achieve the national rights of the Palestinians. They don't think it will end up in a real transfer of authority to the Palestinians. They don't think it addresses the issues of Jerusalem, of security, of frontiers, of the Israeli settlements, of the 1948 refugees. There's a lot of open-ended questions that the Islamists are saying are going to be resolved in Israel's favor and not in the Arabs' favor. They are particularly concerned about the status of Jerusalem, which is the third most holy site for Muslims.
And that's something that's to be decided a few years down the line into the negotiations.
That's right. And the Islamists and the leftists in the Arab world are basically saying the same thing, that this agreement is vague, it leaves too many things open, it doesn't guarantee the Palestinians their national rights, and it should not be accepted because it is being negotiated from a position of weakness.
And the refugees who left Palestine in 1948, why do they feel that this agreement doesn't address them? What's left out for them?
Well, the agreement doesn't specifically deal with their status. It leaves it to the final status negotiations, which will take place 2 or 3 years from now. And the 48 refugees are saying, well, that's not fair. We cannot just sort of wait and see what happens. We want our rights, and we want them now. And, you know, the world doesn't work like that. And the majority of Arabs now, or Palestinians, are saying, we accept that this settlement with Israel must be done in a phased way, step by step, and we have to be patient, and we have to be a little bit more mature and sophisticated than we had been in the past. That asking for everything all at once has always brought us nothing. And therefore, that's why I think a majority of Arabs are behind the agreement now and support it.
What is the voting status of Palestinians in Jordan for this upcoming election?
Well, the Palestinians here who have Jordanian nationality, say like myself, we are full Jordanian nationals. We serve in the army. We pay taxes. We can run for parliament. There's absolutely no distinction legally between a Palestinian, a Jordanian of Palestinian origin, or a Jordanian of Syrian origin, or Iraqi origin, or East Bank Trans-Jordanian origin. So anybody who has a full 5-year Jordanian passport can vote, and that's the majority of Palestinians. There's a small number of Palestinians, I think it's around maybe 100,000 or so, that have temporary 2-year passports, and these people are not eligible to vote. They do not have full nationality rights, nor do they have the full obligations of serving in the army and things like that.
And would you be eligible to vote as a Palestinian in the emerging Palestinian entity? Palestinian entity is what a lot of people are calling it now.
Well, the people who are allowed to vote are the people who live there or who will go back because they were 1967 refugees.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a 1967 refugee, so I could not immediately go back and live in Palestine. I am from the 1948 refugees, and we have to wait for the final status negotiations to see what happens. I think what will happen is in about 2 or 3 years, if everything goes well, there will be an agreement between the Palestinian government that will be established and the Israelis that, okay, some of the 48 refugees can start coming back if they want, and if there's economic means to support them in Palestine, you know, why not let them come back slowly if everything goes well. So I think the future course of repatriation of Palestinians in Palestine is really very much unknown right now. It could move very quickly, and it could be just a trickle.
Can I ask how you ended up in Jordan?
Well, our family is from Nazareth. We lived. My father left Palestine in 1947. Actually, he went to New York as one of the first Arab foreign correspondents. He was based in New York, writing for several Palestinian newspapers and broadcasting for the Palestinian radio as well. And then the 48 war broke out. He was stuck in New York. He was immediately stateless and a refugee. He couldn't go back to Palestine because Israel had been created. So he was lucky. He got a job with the United Nations in New York, and I happened to be born there at that period in 1948. And then we spent many years living in the United States and Lebanon and Switzerland, where my father worked with the UN. And then when I finished my university work in the United States at Syracuse University, I went back to Lebanon in the very early 1970s, worked there for a couple of years in journalism, and I came here in 1975 in Amman, Jordan, where I live now and have lived ever since.
So you really have lived around the world.
Well, this is part of the Palestinian experience. The Jews talk of their exile in Babylon and in Egypt and different places, and we talk of our years of living overseas and whether I happen to have a relatively easy life in material terms. I was lucky. My father had a good job. I was educated. I have a good professional life, and there's many Palestinians like that all over the world, but there are also hundreds of thousands who have lived in squalid refugee camps, who have been unable to send their kids for education or medical treatment because they didn't have a passport, they couldn't get a visa to travel to another country, they couldn't get their kids into university. So most of the Palestinians have had a difficult time, but many of them have also done well professionally, and it's very exciting now to see this reconstitution of Palestine as people with skills and experience and professional qualifications come back to Palestine to build it up, very much like many Jews from around the world went to Israel. And there's many parallels between the Israeli and the Palestinian, the Israeli and the Jewish experience on one hand and the Palestinian experience on the other hand. And that's when the Palestinians and the Israelis finally get together in the context of peace, I think you're going to see, you know, dynamism that this region hasn't seen since the days of Abraham and Moses and Jesus.
On the whole, I'd say you sound very optimistic about the future of relations between the PLO and Israel, about the future of democratization in the Arab world, about the future of a Palestinian state. Is this kind of optimism something new to you, or have you kept this optimism even during the many years when it seemed like an agreement was a nearly impossible thing?
Well, I was always convinced throughout, say, the 1970s and the 80s, that this moment would have to come. We couldn't predict when and how it would come, but I knew it would come one day because there was no options. I mean, the Israelis were not going to defeat us, and we were not going to defeat them. Neither of us was going to just drop off the edge of the earth. Neither of us was going to allow ourselves to be wiped out as a national culture and spread all over the world. We both have a legitimacy and an authenticity to our national identity and to our humanity, and we must manifest that in our ancestral land, which is Palestine. So I knew one day there had to be a political settlement, and it just took time. It took time for the post-Holocaust generations of Jews to recognize the humanity and the reality of the Palestinians, and it took time for the Palestinians to come to terms with the existence of Israel. That process has gone on for almost 100 years. I mean, the Zionism was born in around 1894, 1895, when Theodor Herzl wrote his famous The Jewish State book in Europe, and now we're, 1993. It's almost 100 years that Zionism and Arab-Palestinian nationalism have been struggling in Palestine. I think that's enough. I mean, four or five generations of conflict is sufficient for two people who do not deserve to be eternally engaged in hand-to-hand combat. And I think both of us have recognized this, and therefore we've sat down and come to this agreement. But I was always sure that it would have to happen, and I've always worked for a peaceful resolution, but a peaceful resolution that is just and that is equitable and that gives both sides equal rights. I mean, Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin do not have more rights than I do. Their blood is the same as my blood, their faith is the same as my faith, and their children are the same as my children. There is nothing that differentiates us. They had a difficult historical experience in the Holocaust in Europe. They were discriminated against in North America and in Russia and in Spain and all over the place. And their historical experience has been certainly more difficult and more savage than mine. I accept that. And when they were discriminated against as Jews all over the world, they came back to Palestine. And our natural reaction in Palestine was, there's no problem. This is natural for Jews to come to Palestine because they always lived there. They're part of the culture. There's Jews all over the Middle East, in all the major cities, in Yemen, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Baghdad, in Egypt, Morocco. There was major Jewish communities. So they came back to Palestine, and the problem started when they said they wanted a Jewish state only for Jews, and therefore we had the problem. Now they have matured, we have matured, and we're both coming to terms with the reality of the other. We're stopping this silliness of dehumanizing and demonizing and trying to kill the other person and saying that let the future be like the past. Let the future be a Palestinian reality that accommodates all of the three religions, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and that can accommodate two nationalisms if we decide that in an age of nationalisms we want to have an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. Fine, we can accept that, and that's what's happening now.
Rami Khoury is a Palestinian-Jordanian journalist. He writes an internationally syndicated column. We spoke to him from his home in Amman, Jordan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Frank Conroy. He wrote his acclaimed memoir, Stop Time, when he was 27. Now, 26 years later, he's written his first novel. In the interim, he headed the NEA's literary program and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, played jazz at Greenwich Village bars, and drank too much. Also, commentator Gail Pemberton reflects on the importance of African-American magazines like Ebony and Jet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has unveiled a new trade strategy that he says will help American high technology companies sell more of their products abroad. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton proposed getting rid of outdated Cold War restrictions on some types of computers and telecommunications systems, and he proposed using a more aggressive approach to boost the sale of U.S. products and services. During the campaign, Clinton had promised he'd develop new policies to increase U.S. exports. Today, he predicted that his new national export strategy would almost double U.S. exports by the end of the decade and create 6 million new jobs. Although there will still be restrictions on technologies that could contribute to the production of nuclear weapons, the president proposed today to get rid of a series of rules designed to prevent the sale of key technologies to the Soviet Union. Mr. Clinton plans to lift the export license restrictions on certain types of computers, mostly sophisticated personal computers and low-level workstations. A senior administration official estimated that lifting the Cold War controls would free up an additional $30 billion worth of U.S. exports. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Clinton administration and the big three U.S. automakers have proposed a government-industry partnership they hope will result in highly efficient and environmentally friendly automobiles. Don Gagne reports.
President Clinton was joined at the White House by CEOs from General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler in announcing the project, which is being compared to the Apollo moon landing in terms of the technological challenges it presents. The goal is for each of the big three to take one car model and triple the number of miles it can travel on a tank of fuel, all the while keeping the car affordable. That, according to the president, will be good for the environment while improving the competitiveness of the domestic car industry.
We want American cars at the head of this parade, not bringing up the rear. Believe me, there'll be a huge market for them.
Under the project, government scientists will team up with industry engineering teams. Funding will be shared by government and industry, but no dollar amounts were specified today. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne reporting.
Investigators are wondering if a towboat's radar was on the night an Amtrak train crashed into an Alabama bayou. Officials think one of the six barges the towboat was pushing may have struck a rail bridge, leading to the train wreck that killed 47 people. The radar had a range of 24 miles. Despite heavy fog, it could have alerted the towboat crew of the bridge's presence. A spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board says the radar was okay when it was checked after the crash, but lawyers for the four crew members aren't permitting their clients to be interviewed. The Commerce Department says the nation's gross domestic product grew slowly during the second quarter of this year. The GDP expanded at 1.9% between April and June. Stocks closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow gained a fraction of a point to end at 3,566.30. This is NPR. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton told senators today the administration's proposed health care plan will make American workers more secure and more productive. The First Lady is continuing a round of appearances on Capitol Hill promoting the health care plan. She's picked up an early endorsement of the plan from Republican James Jeffords of Vermont, one GOP senator the White House had hoped to win on its side. But more conservative members of the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee expressed doubt over whether the White House's plan will cover all Americans. The Russian government today issued another ultimatum to those occupying the Russian Parliament building. They have until next Monday to end their occupation. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The statement warned of serious consequences if the rebel members of parliament do not give up their arms and leave the building by October 4th. But at the same time, the statement said the government would not resort to firearms to enforce the deadline. Authorities here let a similar ultimatum issued yesterday pass this morning without incident. The Russian Defense Minister, Pavel Grachev, warned today that supporters of those inside the parliament are seeking a campaign of terrorist acts against the leaders of the Russian government. Such acts, Grachev warned, would bring large-scale bloodshed. The retired general who is leading the defense of the parliament building warned that if security forces get too close to the building, his men would open fire without warning. Despite the heated rhetoric, the day passed uneventfully. Thousands of riot police deployed in the freezing rain maintain a tight cordon around the building. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
International charities are pulling staffers out of Somalia's embattled capital, Mogadishu. Many cite dangers they say are made worse by United Nations military operations. The relief groups say Somali gunmen are threatening to take Americans or other foreigners hostage if the UN carries out its plan to take Somali warlords into custody. Several aid workers have been killed this year in Somalia, and others have been robbed and assaulted. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Frank Conroy's first novel has just been published, and it's something of an event in the literary world. People have been expecting him to write a novel for about 27 years, ever since the publication of his acclaimed memoir, Stop Time. But after Stop Time, his life fell apart. It wasn't until 18 years later that he completed his second book, a collection of short stories called Midair. After Midair, he became the head of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, one of America's most important writing programs. His new novel, Body and Soul, is the story of a young musical prodigy who lives in poverty but finds a wonderful, dedicated teacher. He goes on to become a great musician. I asked Frank Conroy if there were any parallels between him and his character.
I've played the piano all my life. In fact, I played professionally as a jazz pianist for about 5 years and sort of Bush League for another 5 years. I played jazz, and I don't. The hero of this book is a prodigy and is a very, very good pianist. I'm a competent jazz pianist. I didn't have a teacher. In a way, that's probably, you know, that every novel contains fantasies, I think, and this one, fantasies about teachers and father figures. And I didn't have a father. I didn't have a teacher, but Claude does. You see.
Well, your father left the family when you were about three or something.
That's right. He was a manic depressive, so he was institutionalized most of the time. They didn't have lithium in those days.
And what about not having a piano teacher? What was the reason for that?
There was a boarder in our apartment who was a professional musician, and there was an attempt... there was an attempt at him giving me some lessons, but he was a sadistic psychopath, and it turned me off. It turned me off very rapidly. The whole idea of piano lessons—you know—he used to squeeze my neck with his fingers, and say, he really was—he was nuts. But so I went back and I learned myself. I learned very slowly. At first, I learned the blues, boogie woogie, which I picked up, off the radio from Harlem uptown, and I just stuck with it. In the writing of this book, I had to go back and really re-educate myself about music from the beginning on, and I had to learn some new stuff, some stuff that I didn't know. The 12th tone. In particular, was a challenge.
It's funny, coming out of a background where you had no father figure and no teacher, you kind of went on to, among other things, become a very well-known teacher as the head of the writers' program at the University of Iowa.
Yes, and I also have three sons.
You were, I think, 27 when your memoir, Stop Time, was published.
Yes, I guess I was 27 when the first excerpt came out in The New Yorker.
And... After Stop Time was published, very acclaimed and so on, I think it was about 10 years until you wrote another book?
Yes.
I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but what happened in the interim?
A certain amount of trouble in my life, a sort of serious trouble. The end of my first marriage, I had to leave... my two kids, which was difficult for me because, my father left. My mother died a very long, slow process, and there was really nobody else to look after her except me, and that was very draining. And it was a difficult time. Also, I didn't have any money, and I'd spent so many years writing. I didn't, I really didn't have the training to do any kind of ordinary job. So it was tough. It was a tough time.
What was it like for you to be looking after your mother? From your memoir, Stop Time, you'd get the feeling your mother didn't always do such a good job looking after you.
That's true. I hope I did a better job. But, good heavens, the woman was dying. I had to, I went to the... First of all, getting her into a hospital was hard. And she was in and she was out, and then I took her back in the last time. If you've read my story, Midair, there's a story in there where it's autobiographical, and it's one of these things. It really happened, but it's one of those things you can't put into a story because it's too convenient. I was driving her to the hospital for what I knew would be the last time, down the Merritt Parkway from Connecticut into New York, and we had both been so preoccupied with this that we forgot. And as we were driving along, suddenly it got dark. And everything changed in the exterior world. It's because there was an eclipse of the sun, mm-hmm. And that actually happened. So I put it in the story.
Boy, that is the kind of thing I think you might have been afraid to put in the story because it seems like it's too much the metaphor.
Yes, but it happened. Not that that's really any defense. Students will often say that to me, but it happened, And I say, well, I don't care if it happened. It isn't any good. But there, I just couldn't stop myself from doing it. I put it in and I thought it worked.
My guest is writer Frank Conroy. His new novel is called Body and Soul. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Frank Conroy is my guest. Your father was a drinker, and you went through a period when you were drinking a lot too. Did that make it even worse? Did you have this fear of that you were picking up some of the habits of a man who you barely knew?
Well, I don't think I felt I was picking up his. Whatever sins or stupid things or self-destructive things I was doing were really not modeled after anyone. They were I found them myself, you know. But yes, indeed. It's funny, I've noticed this about a lot of artists. They have a very peculiar relationship to their body, as if it's just some old suitcase you have to lug around with you, some old battered up suitcase. And so there's a and I certainly had that. I didn't take care of myself, and I drank too much. I smoked a lot. I finally stopped smoking. But I didn't help matters, I think, by the various methods that I used to escape the depression and the confusion that I felt.
Well, I really like your description about how a lot of artists see their body as...
Yeah, we live in our heads so much, the important stuff really takes place in some kind of hyperspace inside the brain or inside the imagination. And I know a number of, Marilyn Robinson, I was talking to her, and it turns out that, I write in bed. I always have, ever since the beginning. I put up pillows behind my back, and, I put the legal pad across my knees and write. And it's funny. I really need to do that. And I found out that Marilyn also writes in bed. And we were laughing about it because what we're trying to do, of course, is sort of deny the existence of our bodies at all. You know, you get in bed.
Right.
As if, you know...
As if it's time to dream and just, like, lose consciousness.
Yes, and, you know, you do everything to sort of minimize your physical awareness of your body while you enter the dream of the work, you know, and you're concentrating very intensely. And, you see pictures and you hear sounds and smells, and you're doing all of this. And your body seems to have nothing to do with it.
Well, did that ever change for you? Did you ever get to feel that... you had to take care of your body and kind of
sure it did
be a part of your physical self and all
yeah,
of
sure
that.
It did.
What brought you around on that?
Well, a couple of things. One, I went too far, and so I finally woke up that, hey, Frank, you know, I said to myself, this is crazy. You know, you better stop this stuff. So there was that, and then there was the birth of my third child, who is 6 years old, and that changes things. And advancing age, you know, I'm 57. So I stopped smoking. I didn't stop drinking. I still drink a little bit in the evening, maybe a little bit too much sometimes, but it's very much under control, and I live a very stabilized life and have for quite a while.
Was there any connection between kind of getting back into your body, so to speak, and writing more prolifically again, or being more satisfied with what you wrote?
No, I don't think it had to do with that. To some extent, I think it had to do with being able to live in a fairly stable situation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so much my relationship to my body, but my relationship to the world itself. I mean, I like a stable... I need a stable... A stable environment where I don't wake up in the middle of the night thinking, God, how am I going to pay the rent, or how am I going to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Poverty can be very claustrophobic. I mean, when I was living in Nantucket, the house wasn't heated, wasn't finished. In the winter, you know, I mean, if a pipe broke, I mean, I'd be down there in the crawl space with the torch, the butane torch. And it was a big deal. I mean, I couldn't get a plumber to do it. I had to go down and do it myself. And, so I'd spend half the day crawling around under there trying to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I sure do, yeah.
I mean, I think in a way you have to have been there to really understand it. But it's very time-consuming and energy-consuming to be broke. It's as simple as that.
Did you have just different personalities in New York and on Nantucket?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure, because there was a period of sort of quite severe depression, separating the two time eras, mm-hmm. the two time zones. I mean, I would have these panic attacks, very bad, sort of paralyzing, actually. And, you know, that was before they had drugs to deal with that sort of stuff. So, you know, you just had to go through it.
What would panic you?
Oh, it's exactly, you know, it's just totally classic. I mean, it's what, it's like what Freud talks about. It's a panic. The patient is terrified, but you ask the patient what the patient is terrified, and they can't tell you. In other words, you're not afraid of something. You are just in a state of panic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not rational.
Mm-hmm.
It's somatic. Your heart is going like crazy, and eventually it gets better.
Your memoir Stop Time begins and ends with you in a Jaguar driving very fast from London to about 20 miles south of the city where you lived.
Yes.
And the prologue is about the release of that drive, the release of driving really fast in a sports car.
Yeah.
The epilogue is the car crash, where you nearly get killed and you're miraculously saved because the car nearly gets wrapped around a fountain.
Yes.
That
was prophetic, wasn't it?
What do you mean?
I mean... in Stop Time, that's a warning. And in a sense, maybe I was warning myself, because it wasn't a car and a particular fountain, but I was living pretty dangerously later, and I was lucky to get out unscathed.
Do you still vividly remember the moment of the crash?
No, I was pretty drunk. it was late. I remember it, but I remember more what I was thinking than I have an actual sense memory of the event. You know, I remember more what I was thinking, which is that I was really, it seemed to me that, you know, I could die. I mean, I remembered. It was interesting because it didn't particularly frighten me.
Do you think that's because you were drunk?
No, it happened to me later when I was sober. I had at one point about 10 years ago, I had a hemorrhaging duodenal ulcer, and I went to the hospital real fast, and the doctor told me later that I had 15 minutes. You know, I had tops. If it had been 15 minutes longer, I would have been DOA. But I knew when I was in that emergency room, when you see that there are 9 people around you and every one of them is doing something, you know that you're in trouble. And, of course, I was bleeding. I was hemorrhaging. There was blood all over the emergency room. And I knew I could die right then. And I didn't feel frightened. And that time I was certainly quite sober. I didn't feel frightened. I felt like, what a shame. I mean, this is too early. I've got stuff to do.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Frank Conroy's new novel is called Body and Soul. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Moscow?
Well, we'll be hearing from Mike Schuster in Moscow about what's happening around the Russian parliament and what's going on inside the Russian parliament, as President Boris Yeltsin has given the parliamentarians who are inside a deadline of Monday to get out, or presumably the building might be stormed by troops that are now surrounding it. Also, we'll be hearing from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, about the very perilous situation of the government of Eduard Shevardnadze, a report about the sculpture of Zimbabwe, of the Shona people of Zimbabwe. The Bosnian parliament votes to reject the peace plan negotiated in Geneva. And we'll be hearing from former President Jimmy Carter about human rights and rights abuses.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Gail Pemberton remembers growing up in a house filled with African-American magazines and newspapers, from Crisis, the official publication of the NAACP, to one called Silhouette, Hollywood Pictorial. Gail was thinking about the place of black magazines in our culture recently after devouring some copies of Essence, Ebony, American Visions, and Jet.
A few weeks ago, I took a train, my preferred mode of travel, from New York to Chicago. I love trains for many reasons, but most of all for the time they allow for reading and thinking. On this particular trip, I loaded myself up with a stash of black magazines that I'd been saving for months. Finally, there was time to read them. I suspect that black magazines were among some of the first things I did read. They were always a fixture in my family's home. Some of these magazines are no longer published, but I remembered poring over their pages, looking at photographs, and reading articles on the living conditions, health, employment, and education of black Americans. I consider them vital to my education. In 1955, I was not old enough to understand the meaning of lynching, but the photograph of the mutilated body of 14-year-old Emmett Till on the cover of Jet provided a quick lesson I will never, ever forget. I will also remember the feelings of pride I had in seeing the full complement of black major leaguers on the pages of Ebony every year. I remembered that little girl pride while reading an August issue of American Visions, which featured an article on the Black Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. Seeing a 1945 photograph of the legendary Kansas City Monarchs, including Satchel Paige and a baby-faced Jackie Robinson grinning at the camera, sent me into a reverie. I thought about everything from my baseball-loving grandfather and father and the trials and tribulations of black athletes then to the meaning of the game today and our national yearning to find heroes like there were in those long-gone days. I've had my fights with some black magazines, too, wanting them to provide more critical articles on issues of national and foreign policy, sexism and homophobia, as well as those issues thought to be exclusive to black Americans. This summer, Ebony published a special issue on the new black family, with a photograph of a conservatively dressed black middle-class nuclear family, man, woman, boy, and girl. What is new is not clear since the types of black families in the magazine have been around for years, but the existence of this issue takes on new and significant meaning when it sits next to a recent Newsweek with a cover story called A World Without Fathers, and it's not so new notions either of black families. Reading both magazines provides a kind of counterpoint and a fuller portrait of black families than either alone offers. The world of flesh and blood people behind the otherwise cold statistics of black life still needs black magazines to find expression. I may not be particularly interested in the story of the black steel worker who won millions in Lotto after playing weekly for 10 years, or in the pictures of newlyweds from L.A. to D.C. in the required cake-cutting ritual photograph. But there are other stories I do need, on black women and health in essence, on black sculptors and painters in American visions, and on the impact of racism on the economy in black enterprise. If nothing else, black magazines reveal just how much the social worlds of black and white, with few exceptions, remain as separate as the fingers of their hand. I suspect that very few white Americans have ever read a black magazine to see a different picture than that presented in national magazines or on TV. This is particularly sad given the overwhelming influence of black American music, language, and style on what we call our popular culture and what the rest of the world calls American. The current cover story of Emerge is about the desegregation of traditional black colleges. Reading it reminded me of special Negro education issues of magazines my parents would save, along with copies of Life, Look, and the Saturday Evening Post from the 30s and 40s. I'm not sure how my parents or I would chart the progress of black Americans since then. Certainly many things have changed. Some are for the better, but others are appalling because they've not changed, and others have become worse. Black magazines are a critical gauge of this success, failure, and much, much more.
Gail Pemberton is the author of The Hottest Water in Chicago, Notes of a Native Daughter. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our program is directed by Roberta Shurrock, who is joined in the control room today by her mother, who is visiting the East Coast for the first time. Welcome. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from grants provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh, On the next Fresh Air, is a popular athletic shoe company run by the Ku Klux Klan? Is AIDS a government conspiracy to kill African Americans? We'll talk with Patricia Turner about her new study of rumors in African American culture. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.